You're listening to the MLB.com StatCast Podcast.
Welcome back to the MLB.com StatCast Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Petriello. It is the second week of January, and the hot stove is still kind of ice cold. There's just a ton of talent still out there. So joining me to talk about that and a whole bunch of other stuff about this winter is MLB.com national reporter AJ Cassavell. AJ, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
AJ, you are in studio with me. This is the first time since the very first episode of the show that I've actually had someone here face-to-face where I can actually look at someone and not like hear them, you know, through a phone, from a cell phone, in a ballpark, wherever. So this is a big deal for me.
Yeah, I flew all the way back from San Diego just to be here for this.
Excellent.
For this
I appreciate that. That's a total lie, but I'm going to go with it. It's cool. I really was interested by something you wrote the other day about the National League West. And you, sorry, San Diego, sorry, Colorado. You only looked at the other three teams in the National League West, the Dodgers, the Diamondbacks, and the Giants. Excuse me. And you wrote about how they are shaping up over the course of the offseason. And as I looked today, there were 348 comments on that article. Maybe about three of them weren't yelling at you. So I'm interested, how do you see the NL West shaping up? Because what you wrote is you kind of used the Steamer war projections, which I totally am a big fan of. And what you came out with is that the Dodgers are still kind of ahead, even though their winter hasn't really been the best.
Yeah, and I tried to make it clear in the story that this is just who's the favorite on paper, which technically means nothing. And I think the one key thing that I couldn't really write in the story, if I'm going by the Steamer projections, is how much is the impact of a manager going to have? Because obviously Bruce Bochy on the Giants is head and shoulders above almost anyone else in the majors, especially above two kind of younger managers. But I kind of came to the conclusion that the Dodgers, despite their losses, despite Zach Greinke, and despite the fact that they might not have the same kind of star power in their lineup as the Diamondbacks and the Giants, they're still the team to beat on paper because they're just the most complete team. If you look at the other two teams in the division, the Diamondbacks have some kind of holes in their lineup outside of Goldschmidt and Pollock, and their bullpen, you'd expect it to regress a little bit. And with the Giants, their outfield, even though they signed Denard Span, it doesn't project as well as the other two outfields, and they have some question marks in their bullpen too, even with their starting rotation too, even with the signings. So, I mean, it's a toss up. You can't say one team's gonna win.
Three teams in the mix.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I think you look at what people are saying. Oh, the Diamondbacks. Nobody can see me doing air quotes here except for you. Won the winter, right? Mm-hmm. Because they made the Shelby Miller trade and they got Zach Greinke, and they have Paul Goldschmidt, who is probably the best player in that division. Maybe Buster Posey, you know, kind of back and forth. But I think when you look at it, you know, the Giants, for my money, are maybe the most improved team in that division, not the Diamondbacks.
Yeah.
And I agree with you, you know, about something you said, but that rotation really is much improved now. Even if Samardzija is a 3 or 4 starter, well, they might not need him to be more than that because they have Bumgarner and they have Johnny Cueto. The only thing that makes me not want the Giants to win really is that it's an even year. And I can't get another even year Giants World Series. Like, I can't put up with
it. Well, yeah, they're certainly on course for it. I mean, you talk about winning the winter. The Padres won the winter last year. We all know that pretty much means nothing.
Right. White Sox, too.
Yeah, the White Sox won the winter last year, too. But, yeah, you mentioned Samardzija and Cueto. I think they're both great fits for AT&T Park. Both of them will benefit immensely by the Giants' just overall defensive value, and especially in that infield. Like I said, you can't quantify kind of the X factor that apparently the Giants seem to have or that they have had in the past, but their rotation is much improved. Mike Leake, if you look at Mike Leake's departure, I did a thing on the best upgrades of the offseason. So basically saying, well, the Giants lost Mike Leake, but they gained Johnny Cueto. That's an extra win.
Yeah, that's
an extra
a big win deal.
In Steamer. and then Samardzija after that was about 2.1 wins, and the next pitcher on the agenda that lost ground that they didn't bring back was Ryan Vogelsong, and that's a win and a half. So their rotation's going to be much better. It's such a close race, and that's the reason I wrote the story. It wasn't to actually pick a favorite. It was more so to say, how can you possibly pick a favorite? But I'm going to be the fool that goes ahead and does it.
Remember, all our fancy projections didn't pick the Royals, and then people say that and they forget that literally nobody picked the Royals. Like, nobody picked the Royals. I want to go back to something you wrote in July at Sports on Earth. You wrote about what was at the time the 10 hardest hit baseballs of the season. And I'm wondering, was that a tough afternoon for you to have to go through and like watch clips of baseballs just getting destroyed?
It was fun. I spent a lot of time scrolling on my iPad, just, you know, that the round ball taking it just to the right point in the game. It was actually pretty cool, and some of the things I noticed were most of the hardest hit balls weren't these monster home runs. There were a couple of them, and what I did was I kind of had to. We have the Chapman filter
on
for hardest thrown balls. What I did was I had to take the 10 hardest hit balls by 10 different players,
right.
Which was kind of not my way of saying the Junko, yeah, the Stanton
filter. Stanton's injury kind of put in his own Stanton filter.
Yeah.
He missed half the season. Otherwise, yeah. That's exactly what would happen. But you're right about not all the hardest hit balls are these moonshots. And I happen to know this just because I've looked it up a million times. The hardest hit ball of the season was not a home run. It was by Giancarlo Stanton. It was a single. It was 120 yeah. miles an hour through the left side of the Dodgers infield, I think. And it was on a line. And you're right. So, you know, I'm interested. Obviously, that list would be different if you'd done it now. But when you were, say, evaluating players or evaluating topics, do you, you know, exit velocity is kind of a thing that maybe you use now that obviously wouldn't have used a year ago.
Oh, absolutely. And it's one of the first things I look at now kind of in projecting next season. I think the coolest thing when I was doing that project that I noticed was, without fail, all 10 of them, I think two of them resulted in outs, and both of them were really hard hit baseballs. One of them was Carlos Gonzalez hit a rocket to second base.
Yeah, 117. I actually remember that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so basically what happened was every single time the announcer, whoever was calling the game, mentioned, wow, it was a hard hit ball or what a rope or whatever. And that's the cool thing I think about StatCast is it's stuff we can see, but that now we can also quantify. And so that was fun going through it in the exercise. I think the other thing is when we're looking at hardest hit baseballs, a lot of them did tend to be singles, and they're just singles that they don't even leave the ground. They get maybe 4 or 5 feet off the ground, and yet they still end up on the outfield grass. Mike Trout had one of them. Nelson Cruz had another, and they're both just rockets through the left side.
Yeah, we did some research recently and tried to compare. Does exit velocity correspond well to production? And you'd think it would, and it does. We used weighted on base average, and there's a pretty nice trend line there. And then does exit velocity correspond well to batting average? And it actually not at all, very little, because what is batting average measure? It doesn't care about extra base hits, mm-hmm. right? And then weighted on exit velocity, of course, you hit it harder, you're mm-hmm. more likely to get extra base hits. So it's really been interesting to learn that and kind of see where it comes out in the wash. You know, speaking of guys that hit ball hard, Michael Conforto was on a list you did of 5 potential breakout hitters. Now, I think you even wrote, because you had Corey Seager, Mookie Betts, who I think you wrote that has already kind of broken out, and yeah. I agree, I'm a huge Mookie Betts fan. You put Michael Conforto in there, and as I joked to our mutual editor, Matt Myers, who's a Mets fan, did you make AJ put Michael Conforto on that list? But no, I actually think he's a really interesting player, and he's productive, and when you look at Mets fans freaking out about this winter, saying, where's Cespedes? I think what they overlook is they're going to get a full season of Conforto, not just, you know, the 2.5 months he had. I mean, that's actually kind of a better outfield with him than people give it credit for.
Oh, yeah, without question. And obviously, it makes sense for Mets fans to kind of freak out a little bit because of what Cespedes meant to them in the second half last season. But Conforto has all the tools to break out, especially with the force. You look at the 2 home runs he hit in the World Series last year, both of them he crushed. And so I think and there's another concern that I wrote about in that list, his left-right splits. He wasn't very good against left-handers in the major leagues last year, but he was perfectly fine in the minors. I think he actually hit left-handers a little better.
Yeah, and they didn't really give him much of a chance in the majors last year, right?
They platooned him every single time. So, and obviously, any young left-hander is probably going to struggle when you face Chris Sale or Clayton Kershaw or whoever else. But there's no reason to think he'll be any worse against lefties than, say, anyone else. Than any other left-handed hitter. So I think if you give him a full year and you have to show a little patience early on, the Mets outfield should be just fine.
Yeah, I think that's a better team than people give them credit for. And it's in a division that's pretty nice for them, right? Obviously, the Nationals are good. 2 of those teams are not trying to win this year, the Braves and the Phillies, and they look really stacked for maybe 2 years from now. It's not going to happen this year. The Marlins, coin toss. You know, they have a lot of talent, but a lot of holes. And it's kind of interesting. You look at the National League right now, and there's 6 teams at least who are not going to be competitive this year. In the American League, who's the worst team in the American League right now? Baltimore? Is it Minnesota? Tampa? It's hard to say.
Oakland in there? I don't even know if you can. I don't know.
Whatever we would settle on, they think they can compete this year.
Yeah. Right?
And so you've got a couple teams in interesting situations, like the White Sox, the Orioles, and the Tigers, who are decent, but they need more. They need to go for it. Which one of those teams is actually going to get one of these outfielders? Because they all have big holes in the outfield.
Yeah, I think the Orioles have to get someone. Just because that division seems more wide open than any other one, and to the point where if you sign someone like a Cespedes, all of a sudden you kind of vault yourself right up to the right to the forefront of it. So and Baltimore's the thing about Baltimore's outfield, they can sign someone. It's a smaller outfield. Cespedes won't need if they give him a longer term deal, he won't need to cover as much ground down the road. Plus, they need to do something to replace the hole left by Chris Davis if they don't resign him.
I mean, their outfield right now is Adam Jones and you, me.
Yeah.
I've been pushing for Carlos Gonzalez. I think is a good trade piece there because mm-hmm. you know hits the right field. Justin Upton, I think, has to land in Chicago with the White Sox. I don't think he will necessarily, but it just seems like the most perfect fit for me. And you look at that team, obviously, they've got really nice stars, Chris Sale and Abreu, and they've got Todd Frazier, and there's still a lot of holes. You can't imagine that they are done, right?
Yeah, no, there's no way the White Sox are done, especially if they want to be competitive this year, which they went out and traded for Todd Frazier. I feel like,
that's the whole point.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And I actually did an analysis of using Steamer's WAR, who's the biggest upgrade, and Todd Frazier was number one. Simply because since Todd Frazier's been in the major leagues, the White Sox have gotten -0.5 WAR from their third baseman in those, I want to say, 6 years.
Might as well have had a potted plant.
Yeah, yeah, essentially. And so Todd Frazier, you throw him into the mix, that's a huge upgrade. And you had someone like Justin Upton. The Royals are obviously the favorite in that division because you have to make them the favorite.
Sure.
But
we've underestimated
two wild cards.
I had to ask you about one more free agent. Is Howie Kendrick still alive? Because he's a useful player, and you've heard just about nothing about him all winter.
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing about the qualifying offers is they tend to do that. I mean, Ian Kennedy and Giovanni Gallardo maybe less so than Kendrick, but they're still useful pieces that have kind of gotten pushed to the back burner because they're tied to this draft pick compensation. Kendrick seems like a perfect fit in Arizona. I know someone here wrote about that the other day. If Arizona really wants to be competitive, they kind of need to round out that infield because right now they have three guys who can play defense that are throwing the ball to Paul Goldschmidt but haven't proven themselves at the plate. And Kendrick's a clubhouse guy. He's a veteran. He's won before. So.
Yeah. No, I like Jake Lamb more than most, I think, but that's a good fit. I think Kendrick going back to Anaheim seems like perfect. There's another team that needs a bat. Obviously, he's comfortable there. Wouldn't have to move his family. AJ Casavell, national reporter for MLB.com. Appreciate your time. Thanks for being in person with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right.
I'll fly back again sometime.
All right. Anytime. Thank you. Welcome back to the MLB.com StockCast podcast. I'm your host, Mike Petriello. Very excited to have my next guest. Even though he is younger than me, has a better resume than me, and is a professional broadcaster, probably is going to have a better voice than I do, too. Welcome, Joe Davis, one of the newest member of the Los Angeles Dodgers TV team. Joe, how are you?
I'm doing well, Mike. How are you, man?
I'm doing pretty well. Thanks for taking
Good.
A few minutes. Have to ask, you are the newest member of the Dodgers broadcast team, and there are some big names on that team. Vin Scully, Oral Hershiser, Charlie Steiner, and Omar Garcia-Parra. How do you fit into that mix?
Yeah, it's, first of all, it's something that I'm still, even 2 months after the hiring was announced, I'm still, there's times where I kind of pinch myself. I'm still working on wrapping my mind around being part of a broadcast crew that includes those names, you know, iconic broadcasters like Vin Scully, the greatest ever to do it, Charlie Steiner, and you know, you mentioned Oral and Omar. For me, Oral was doing his thing a little bit before I was a big baseball fan, but it's hard, no matter when you grew up, not to know about Oral. And for me with Omar, you know, I grew up a Cubs fan, and I remember being on the beach, you know, the day that the Cubs acquired him before the deadline, and how excited I was, and I think I was in junior high at that point, and was annoying the heck out of my parents by saying, you know, Noma, saying Noma, and the way the Boston people say it. And now I'm going to be working with a guy. So how I fit in, I don't know. I'll just try, I guess, and do my job the best way that I know how to do it. And for me on TV, that means, you know, getting out of the way. And the analysts are the stars on TV, and that people can see what's going on the screen, so they don't need me to beat them over the head with play-by-play. It's my job to tee those guys up and let the folks at home hear from the real experts.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding here is that you're doing just road games this year, 50 of them. So will you ever even enter Dodger Stadium or cross paths with Vin Scully, or are you kind of totally on a separate team here?
Yeah, no, I will. I'll spend some time around Dodger Stadium. You know, I'll still going to be doing all my stuff for Fox Sports. So I'll have a lot of the time when the Dodgers are at home, I'll be off doing Fox National games on the weekend. But the plan is to be around there as often as I can, and you know, be involved a little bit with the pregame show, maybe on Sportsnet LA, and just be around. I think it's important that I'm not somebody who, you know, once the team is back home, just disappears. I think it'll be important to have a presence, and that's something that I want to have. You know, I want to be out there at the ballpark at Dodger Stadium and around Vin, obviously, as much as I can. And already got a chance to meet him back in December at a function at Dodger Stadium. And, you know, you meet him once, and it's like I could spend every day sitting there listening to this guy talk and learning from him. So I'll take advantage of any time that I can to be with him and be at the ballpark there in LA.
Yeah, I'm interested to know your approach in trying to get to know the roster, because obviously you have to know this roster very well. You can't just, you know, pop in on a road trip and say, I don't know who this third baseman is. So I'm curious to know, what did you know about the roster? I'm sure everybody knows Kershaw and Puig before you took the job. And what's kind of been your approach to getting yourself up to speed on this?
Yeah, well, ironically, you know, I game just about every weekend for Fox, and I didn't have a Dodgers game last year. So, you know, I didn't have the knowledge that comes from doing a game nationally and kind of learning the big picture of the team. But in doing the national stuff, you kind of got to know about all the teams. So I had a pretty good background and base of what they were about, and, you know, strengths and weaknesses and things like that. But like you mentioned, once you're with the team, it becomes a totally different depth of knowledge that you've got to have. So at this point, you know, I'm really starting to dive in now to just spending some time each day reading about each guy and looking up old articles. And I'm using a program called OneNote on my computer where you punch in whatever notes you want, and it syncs to your iPad and syncs to your phone and everything. And so the plan is to have, you know, all the notes plugged in there on OneNote, and I'll have them accessible on my iPad wherever I'm at, whether that's at the ballpark or wherever I may need those notes. So, you know, a big part of it, though, to begin with, Mike, was just trying to learn as much of the history of the organization as I could, because I think that the Dodgers are more intimately tied to their history. It's as significant a part of the team's fabric as it is with any organization in any sport. So I spent a lot of time reading about the history and, you know, just learning all I could about that. But I think there's a point, too, where you have to realize that what is most important is the current team. And I think I flipped that switch around the holidays, where I started to shift the focus from burying myself in the history, which, again, is an ongoing thing. I'll never stop learning about that. But kind of shifting gears and starting to focus on the team that we're going to see on the field this year.
Yeah, I'm interested in you know, your kind of approach to this, because one of the things that comes up in every story about you is your youth. You just turned 28, I believe, and you're probably sick of talking about that, and I don't want to harp on it. But what's interesting for me is that, you know, you kind of came of age in the internet era, right? Like, a lot of the other broadcasters are, you know, 40, 50, 60, 70 years old. They kind of had to adapt to that, and you kind of grew up that way. You could always go to Baseball Reference or read Fangraphs or however much you did. And I wonder, you know, does that kind of color the way you approach using stats and technology in the broadcast, maybe differently than some of the more experienced guys?
Yeah, I suppose it may. I guess I can only really speak for myself and the way I do it. I can tell you that I've had conversations before with people in the business, like, how in the world did anybody do this job before the internet? You know, before you could hop online on the Baseball Reference and the Fangraphs, like you mentioned, and, you know, something as simple as looking up a guy's average from the year before, the on-base percentage or a bio point or whatever it may be. You know, how did you do that 10, 20, 30 years ago? And, you know, obviously beyond 10 years, but, you know, back when Vin started, and even in the 80s and early 90s, how were people doing this stuff? So I guess I am spoiled in that I came into it, you know, when everything's right at your fingertips. I've never had to go through, you know, doing the job without having all that stuff accessible to me.
What kind of stats do you value? And certainly you're not going to go into this job and start dropping weighted runs created plus on everybody, because you have to keep the audience totally understood. But I'm curious, when you're looking to say, well, how good is this player? Where do you start?
You know what? I think the key is to realize how helpful stats like weighted runs created plus and OPS plus and ERA plus are for taking a look at a player and getting a snapshot of where they fall. But then the key is to be able to translate that to something that the viewer and the listener can absorb. So those are some of the first things I look at when I'm looking at a player. I love the stats that compare them to league average, those plus stats. And I'm not going to tell somebody, you know, so-and-so's ERA plus is 98. I'm going to see that myself, understand what that means, and use it to tell somebody he's just below league average. I think that there's a fine line where, you know, you start using too many numbers, and especially numbers that aren't widely recognized categories. It's going to go in one ear and out the other. It's basically going to turn into white noise. And I think it's a hard list. People don't want to hear a bunch of numbers, and they certainly don't want to hear a bunch of, you know, the newer age numbers that aren't as generally accepted yet. But I still do. I use them a lot when I'm taking a look at teams and learning about players and developing the context to be able to give folks over the year.
Yeah, you kind of took the words out of my mouth as far as league average goes, because, you know, even I do the same thing. I don't always say weighted runs created plus of 105. I'll say 5% above league average.
Yes.
And I think that's easier to understand. And that's where I kind of think it's interesting. Obviously, this is the StatCast podcast, so I have to ask a StatCast question. The difference, I think, between the very, very new StatCast stats and some of the quote-unquote advanced stats is that it's not something ephemeral, like a win above replacement that you can't see. You know, it's measuring, it's measuring an outfielder's arm strength, or it's measuring how hard the ball came off the bat. I think that might actually be a little easier to say, well, that you know, Puig home run came off the bat at 98 miles an hour, or whatever the case may be. I mean, I think that's probably easier for people to grasp onto.
Yeah, and you know what, Mike? I think that even for me, though, like 98 miles per hour, okay, so that sounds fast, but where does that fall? I think when we get 10 and 15 and 50 years down the line, and we have all the years of context to compare that 98 mile per hour home run that you referenced to, you know, we're going to be able to say, well, whatever it may be, is the, you know, the hardest hit ball in postseason history, or, you know, at least since they've been tracking it, when we're looking 25 years down the road, or whatever the distance is from now. It's just right now it's so early in the StatCast data that it's hard to give too much context to it. Now, you can obviously do the things like, it's easy to give context when you say this year that's, you know, he has the most balls hit over 100 miles per hour. You know, that's something you can wrap your mind around. But right now, there's just not enough context quite yet, I think, where you can throw out a number arbitrarily like that without surrounding it with something more.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, we look at, for example, Giancarlo Stanton has been on top of all the leaderboards. And I think probably that he's going to be quote-unquote historic. Like 10 years from now, he'll step back, because I can't imagine anybody doing this more. But you're right, we don't know yet. Maybe he's just the leader this year. 5 years from now, we've got somebody else. There's something else I wanted to ask you about. You've probably been noticing that Dodger fans are not thrilled with the winter so far. They feel like the team's taken a big step back. And on the other hand, it still seems like a very talented team. Curious your take on the team you're about to start seeing this year.
Yeah, well, a different personality. Anytime that you lose a guy like Zach Greinke, I think everybody acknowledged that, you know, they're not going to be the same team without him. It's going to be different. I think that what they've done, instead of trying to find a guy who, you know, is going to step in and replace him, which is not realistic. You got the ERA leader in baseball, and you know, guy's been as valuable as any over the last few years. You're not just going to straight up replace the guy, you know, unless you pull off a giant deal for Jose Fernandez or something like that, where you're going to have to get rid of all these pieces that you've spent the last few years stockpiling. They've taken a different approach, clearly, which is building depth. You know, you can never have enough starting pitching. And bottom line, you know, they're going to count on some guys to stay healthy. They're going to count on some guys to stay healthy that haven't historically. You know, guys like Hyunjin Ryu, who's coming off of shoulder surgery, hasn't pitched in 2 years. Brandon McCarthy coming back midsummer off of the elbow surgery. You know, there's a lot of pieces that they have question marks because of the injury history, but there are a lot of potentially good pieces. And you're looking specifically at the starting rotation when you're talking about that. Lineup-wise, they've not done anything significant. You know, some re-signings of guys like Chase Utley and A.J. Ellis. But I think you're counting on a few guys in particular to do what they've shown they can do. Jack Peterson to do what he was doing early on in his rookie year. Yasmani Grandal to do what he was doing before he started dealing with his shoulder injury. Yeah, so there's a couple, and obviously Puig, the elephant in the room, right? Can he be what he was a few years ago? If you get those guys, even two of the three, to produce how they've shown they can produce at the major league level, I think it's a really good lineup.
Well, Joe, you've passed the test. You've clearly been paying attention to the team, so good work on that. Well, I said, final question for you. Joe Davis, newest member of the Dodgers broadcast team. I have read that you've taken your father with you to a lot of your broadcasting jobs, and he's been up in the booth as your spotter. Can we be looking forward to Mr. Davis on some of these Midwest road trips?
That would be a blast to have him with me for baseball. I'd love to have him come, you know, on some of the trips just for the heck of it, to have him tag along and see the big league experience. He actually works I don't like saying works for me. He works for Fox, we'll say that, as my spotter on football games. So whether it's college football or NFL, he is in the booth with me, and Fox pays him well to stand in there and point at my roster chart, at my spotting boards, to the guys that make the tackles, the penalties on, you know, ID, a bunch of different things. Football is really the only sport that calls for that just because of the dynamic, all the guys moving around and so many guys on the field at once. You don't really need a spotter in baseball for obvious reasons of, you know, guys being in fixed positions and coming up in a fixed order. But, yeah, I bet he'll make a trip or two with me once I get settled in and get my own footing. I'd love to have him come along.
That sounds like a good deal. Joe Davis, follow him at @Joe_Davis. Listen to him on 50 games this year for the Los Angeles Dodgers. Joe, really appreciate your time.
Mike, good to talk to you.
Thanks so much to my guests, AJ Cassavell of MLB.com, Joe Davis of the Dodgers. I am your host, Mike Petriello. Catch you next week.